KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Winter Folk 28, a celebration of music, community, and service on February 20th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Winter Folk, an annual benefit for Sisters of the Road, will feature singer-songwriter, author, and social activist David Roth, headlining along with performers Casey Neal, Sky in the Road, Dan Weber, and Kelly Bosworth. Again, that's Winter Folk 28 on February 20th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
On Monday, February 15th, at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will air a Valentine's Day special to bring to light the fact that, because of incarceration, many people are separated from their friends, family, and lovers on Valentine's Day. We will be reading your short messages to your friends and loved ones on air. So whether you are behind bars and reaching out, or are out and reaching in, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our email address is kboppc@gmail.com, and our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Address your messages to Prison Pipeline Collective. Then tune in on February 15th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read on air.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Hi, folks. Yes, it's your old mole show on KBOO Portland, rooting those mountains down. Of course, our theme song was not talking of real mountains. In fact, the coal industry is going great guns to take the tops off of real mountains. We oppose that, of course. The mountains we root down are mountains of avarice and inequality, top-down corporatism, racism, sexism, and the structure of our economic system that operates to sustain those many ugly features of U.S. life, and that was just a short list. So today it's President's Day. The mole doesn't celebrate presidents and the rule by powerful men. We'll do today what we usually do, that is examine and celebrate our movements. Today we present Native American struggle and the Sand Creek Massacre, also the politics of climate change. We review the novel The Other Typist by Suzanne Rindell. And yesterday was Valentine's Day. It's a day when, in the weeks preceding it, of course, we are deluged with advertisements asking us to buy things to celebrate the love and affection, flowers and greeting cards and all the rest of it. And also, of course, having safe sex, using many products that add to our gross national product and spending statistics. Anyway, we lead today's show with a discussion of love and sexuality. Actually, young love, indeed, sex ed in the schools. It's a fractious issue, to say the least. I'm Bill Resnick, your host today. I talked to Jody Sokolauer, a writer, activist, teacher. She teaches a radically democratic and sex-positive version of sex ed, and the parents and kids love it. So first, Jody Sokolauer.
That there's just too little of. But what the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone. Lord, we don't need another mountain.
Jody Sokolauer, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, glad to be here.
Jody Sokolauer taught in the Bay Area at Berkeley High School and other schools. She's also a writer, editor, political activist. She is now managing editor of the journal Rethinking Schools. Jody, I was reading the recently published book, Rethinking Sexism, Gender, and Sexuality, that you wrote for and edited with a lot of other people. I read your article, Elbow is Not a Sexy Word, Approaches to Sex Education. Reading that and other articles in the book, I came to a much greater realization what a school can be. And it's not just to prepare kids for taking tests and making the kids attractive to employers, but for exploring the world, for exploring themselves, for developing themselves as humans. It was really inspiring for me, actually. Tell us about your work when you taught high school sex ed.
Well, when I taught sex ed, it was actually part of a year-long course for ninth graders called Identity and Ethnic Studies, which was wonderful because it meant that before we were talking explicitly about sex education, we really explored racism and immigration and sexism. And so we had a chance to build community, and we also had a chance for the kids to get used to talking with each other about the kind of things that people don't always talk about. That's kind of the basis. So I'm happy to talk about how I approach the unit on sex ed, but it's always in the context of you have to build community first, and that it's really good for kids to have a grounding in sexism, including homophobia, before you launch into these kind of things.
Sort of some kind of critical thinking, looking at the world not as something that's just a given and that impacts you and you have to somehow maneuver around to invest in yourself, but a world that can be changed and that has many flaws and historical flaws. I gather that's a basic sort of essence of the curriculum.
Yes, absolutely. So in terms of thinking about teaching sex ed, the things in my mind, like what I was trying to show in this article, is that most sex ed in this country, not just in this country, is pretty terrible. It's totally based on assumptions that everybody is heterosexual. And it's also either abstinence-based, saying, you know, don't have sex and no information about other alternatives, or else what we think of as inclusive sex ed is often based on a harm reduction model. So that's like, really, you should wait, but if you absolutely have to have sex, let us give you the information so you can protect yourself from all the horrible things that could happen. So the way in this article I'm trying to show sex ed is inclusive so that everybody, all the students in the class, feel comfortable, whether they identify in terms of gender with the biological gender that was assigned to them at birth, whether they think they're queer or gay or straight or they're not sure, and whether they come from a family that's open and talks about sexuality or they come from a family where it's never mentioned. I just want to make sure that everybody feels comfortable and everybody feels like their reality and the stage they're at is supported. And also, I wanted it to be sex positive, to be coming from a perspective that if people in the relationship are equal, everybody has an equal voice, it's based on a lot of communication, and everybody's doing what they want to do, and they have all the information they need to make good decisions, that sexuality can be one of the great joys of life. So let me give you an example that's kind of midway through the article, that's something that I did midway through the unit that might be an example. So this is after we'd already had a lot of basic information about what's the difference between safer sex and birth control and studied the anatomy and learned about different forms of birth control and safer sex. I asked the kids to do a brainstorm. What are all the things you might want to do with somebody you're attracted to, somebody who you might want to be intimate with? And we made this huge list on the board. And I get things started by saying, make them a cake, you know, send them a Valentine's present, oral sex, you know, so I got kids throwing out suggestions from all over. And I try to make sure that everything got represented. So on the one hand, if nobody said anal sex, I would say that. On the other hand, if nobody said hold hands, if everything was like going in like totally intense directions, I'd suggest that. So once we had the whole board covered with all the different things you might want to do with somebody who you liked or wanted to get closer to, I'd ask the kids to take out a piece of paper and draw a line. And we did a lot of work with continua. So seeing things not as like all one thing or all another, but more on a gray scale. So we'd already looked at gender as a gray scale, not that everybody's like totally male or totally female, but that many people are somewhere in between.
Even biologically, much less.
Even biologically, yes.
Much less in terms of temperament and taste and understandings
and desires. Well, self-identity, right. Yeah. And also we looked at that in terms of sexuality, that everybody isn't all heterosexual or all homosexual, that many people are on a continuum. So I asked the kids to take out a piece of paper and draw a continuum, draw a long line, and on the left, write least intimate, and on the right, write most intimate. And then I asked them to take all the different things we'd put on the board, say 30 things or 35 things, and put them on the line. And I assured them that this was just for them. I wasn't going to collect it. They didn't have to tell anybody. This was just for themselves, to be as honest as they could and put everything on the line from least intimate to most intimate. And if there was something that they knew they would never want to do, just leave it off. Don't stress. And then when the kids had all the things on the line, I asked them to number them, starting with 1 for the least intimate and 35 or whatever the biggest number was for the most intimate. And then I asked a bunch of questions, like, could somebody volunteer, what do you have for 13? And a couple people volunteered that. Then I said, would somebody volunteer to say one of the things they had for the last three things, the three most intimate things? And without pressuring anybody to share, but, you know, the thing is, when you're talking about sex, kids actually really like to talk about it, and they really like to share.
And like to think about it if they have the room to, right?
It seems to me it's
a wonderful opportunity to talk about values and possibilities and what people want to be.
Just
reading your article, I saw, wow, what a privilege to be teaching sex ed in this way.
Right.
Because the kids are into it, yes.
So once everybody had numbered things and they started throwing out where different things fit on their continuum, I'd say, wow, what are you noticing? And the kids would start talking about how, like, for example, oral sex is an example of something that for some of the students in the class and some people in the world, this isn't, you know, just about kids, oral sex was something that was quite far on the intimacy level. And for other people, it was like no big deal, that it was something that would go far before, like you would introduce somebody to your parents or something like that. And I said, well, what do you think that means? And the kids would start saying things like, oh, my God, you really have to talk to people. Like, there's no way to know what somebody's thinking or how they feel or, like, what comes next. You know, and I always have kids that, like, well, can't you just tell what a girl likes? And the point of that exercise is really for the kids to realize that you really need to talk, you know, that you can't assume or you can't intuit what somebody feels like is the next step in terms of intimacy. You really have to have a discussion. And so that's a lead-in to a lot of discussions about, like, what does enthusiastic consent sound like? You know, that an absence of no doesn't mean enthusiastic consent, that you really need a positive affirmation that this is something that somebody is really into doing. So that's just kind of an example of one of the exercises that I talk about in that article. But the goals of the whole approach to sex ed in that article are about inclusiveness, you know, being sure that you don't make assumptions when you're teaching, that all your examples aren't based in heterosexual relationships, that they're not all based in people who clearly define themselves as male or female, that there are examples that are based in people who are genderqueer and that have many different sexualities, and that you're really talking about community and communication.
And I suppose honesty and respect for others. Yeah.
Absolutely. And equality. You can't have a positive sexual relationship with somebody if you're not both on an equal standing. So that's where you can have a more of a conversation with kids about, like, what makes something sexual abuse? What are the implications if somebody is much older or is in a position of authority? You know, so you can talk about things that are dangers, but it's in the overall context of this is education for your whole life. And sex is actually something that might end up playing a very positive role in bringing you and your partner or partner's joy.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon. I'm talking to Jody Sokolauer. We were talking about sex education, how it engaged students, could be so enlightening to students. Jody Sokolauer, the book you wrote for and edited, Rethinking Sexism, Gender, Sexuality, it was, of course, not just about sex education. It examined how classroom teachers were taking on issues of respect and equality and respect for differences and offering humanistic values and allowing kids to talk about it and how they employed them. So let's talk about the book now. What was so interesting about it is that this doesn't happen just in sex education classes. Your kids get a sense of the history of struggles from below. Tell us about the book.
Okay. We had this great committee of six different editors working on this book. We worked on it for 3 or 4 years, forever. And we really spent a lot of time thinking about what the main values that we wanted to project in the book. So it included building a community that feels inclusive, where everybody feels supported, not just students, but also parents and teachers and staff. We wanted it to be intersectional so that it really comes across that you can't be LGBTQ friendly or supportive and then be racist. There's a very strong connection of all social justice issues, so that all the curriculum and everything that we included in the book was about building community and building curriculum that supports everybody and that understands the interrelationship between racism and sexism. So the different sections of the book, there's a section on building safe classrooms, safe, supportive, and inclusive classrooms. There's a long section on curriculum about how to integrate issues of sexism, gender, and sexuality into curriculum from preschool through teacher education classes. There's a section on coming out at school and what those issues are. There's a section on outside the classroom, like organizing on a district level or a school level. And there's a section specifically devoted to teacher education. And you can find this book at our website, which is rethinkingschools.org. And just on the lower left of the landing page, there's a picture of the cover with a beautiful illustration by Fabian Rodriguez. And if you just click on there, it'll take you right to where you can order the book.
Let me say one final thing. The book is not just for teachers. It's really very inspiring in terms of thinking about the possibilities for parents to work with their children and for recognizing that there's really a lot of action in the society. The creation of kind of social lives and schools and families that really respect honesty and try and be democratic. It's very inspiring, especially for those who see the wounded warriors of the world and many really disturbing things that are happening. There's also a lot of good things happening in many places. Jody Sokolauer, thanks so much for doing this book and for your work.
All right. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Young love.
They say for every boy and girl there's just one love in this whole world, and I know I found mine. The heavenly touch of your embrace tells me no one can take your place.
Young love.
Yes, young love, first love. Hi, folks. You heard Jody Sokolauer on a liberated democratic version of sex ed, and she was sandwiched between Dionne Warwick, young sweet love, and Perry Como's young love, true love. Coming up on The Mole, a short piece on progressive strategy for preventing catastrophic climate change. And a review of the novel, The Other Typist, by Susan Rendell, our reviewer, Larry Bolden. Next on The Mole, Lori Mercier and her guests from the Cheyenne Arapaho and the Cheyenne Lakota tribes, and also Katie Anderson from the Vancouver and the Clark County Historical Museum. They discuss the Sand Creek Massacre, the continuing struggle against dispossession, the struggle by Native Americans. Lori and guests...
Thanks, Bill. With me in the studio are George Levi, Cheyenne artist from Oklahoma, Brent Learned, Arapaho artist from Oklahoma, and Katie Anderson of the Clark County Historical Museum in Vancouver. They are here to talk about the incredible exhibit, One November Morning, the Sand Creek Massacre, which features the work of Oklahoma-based Cheyenne and Arapaho artists who work in different mediums in remembrance of their Sand Creek ancestors. This exhibit opened on Saturday and will be up until May 28th. Welcome to KBOO, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Well, let me just tell or remind listeners about the Sand Creek Massacre, which occurred on November 29th, 1864. It's one of the worst atrocities in American history. The Colorado Militia, under the command of Colonel John M. Shivington, encouraged by the U.S. Army Major General Samuel Curtis, massacred more than 150 Cheyenne and Arapaho, mostly elderly men, women, and children. So George Levi and Brent Learned, tell us how this exhibit came together in light of the 150th remembrance of this massacre.
2 years ago in 2014, in the spring, we knew that the 150th anniversary was going to be on November 29th. So we was talking amongst ourselves and said, we need to do something as artists, do something that has never been done before from our own perspective as descendants of Sand Creek. So we got this together, got three other artists, BJ Stepp, Merlin Little Thunder, and Nathan Hart, and we put our heads together and came up with what we have. We're just trying to tell the story of our people.
You know, it was one of those things that it was an honor to be a part of this because, for one, it was, to my knowledge, it's one of the first times that tribal members have come together and to pick an historical event to tell the tragedy of a massacre period.
And why is it so important to remember this particular massacre, one of many in American Indian history, but of particular importance to the Cheyenne and Arapaho?
We, me and Brent, as Cheyenne and Arapaho tribal members, a vast majority of all Cheyenne and Arapaho tribal members grew up hearing these stories, these atrocious stories from our grandparents, from our parents. And it's part of who we are. It's part of our DNA and everything. So it's just, it happened all over, but Our people went through so much that day, and it's still haunting us today.
And it's one of those things that the stories are, you know, you hear about them, you know, because that was a generation lost that we'll never know what they could have been and whatnot. And for a lot of those people that were elderly, women, kids, and the way they died was horrific, and it should have never have happened.
And we were talking earlier, Brent, about the Holocaust and the importance of remembering. Yet you have heard many times people say it's time to get over this, that we need, you know, you Indian people need to move on. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I was always taught as a young kid that you always got to remember where you came from in life to know where you're going. And for my mother, you know, she was a Cheyenne Arapaho, and to have those stories that of her growing up during the Depression and being hit with a ruler and not to speak her language and everything, you know, as Cheyenne people in Arapaho, we tell our stories orally. It's passed on from generation to generation, and to forget those ancestors is a disrespect. So the reason why George and I and Merlin and the other guys got together to do this project is we wanted to tell their stories because they didn't have a voice. And so through our art, we were depicting those stories to tell our side, because when you look up Sand Creek on Google or in just research papers, period, there's not any visual material to look at. And so we wanted to put a face to that so where people could actually draw from and actually see what it was actually like. Because when you read it, is one thing, but when you see it visually, it's right there in your face, and you can't really walk away from it.
And this art has the power to move us in ways that reading that history really does not. And let's talk about this amazing art that you both do for a few minutes. And George, do you want to talk about just the brilliant, searing colors that you use in your paintings and why? That's Brent's paintings and George the ledger art. Okay, yes. Let's talk about your paintings, Brent.
The way I paint is I usually paint and depict images of daily life among the plains, you know, where they're hunting, buffalo scenes and whatnot. And so when I started doing these pieces for the Sand Creek, you know, it took a lot out of me emotionally and physically, because I typically don't do those type of scenery because they're pretty graphic, you know, and the stories of the men, you know, after the battle, you know, for one, you've already killed your enemy, but to take a step further and disgrace him by cutting up body parts and everything, how am I to portray that to where it's not going to offend anything? But then again, I didn't want to censor myself as an artist. I figured, well, I just got to put it out there. And so one of the pieces that really speaks to me is it's called Who's the Real Savage? And it's depicting a man cutting the breast off of a woman who they had already had their way with. And it's telling the history, you know, because as an artist, you are an historian of your time. And to tell the story of what happened in the past and draw from those stories and from that imagery to depict to a variety of audience where they can actually feel that punch. And so I try to convey that in the colors, and those colors pull you in. But yet, the actual imagery just really tears at the heart.
And that was a particular feature of this massacre, the dismemberment of.
Yeah, they paraded the bodies around downtown Denver. You know, not too many people realize that. You know, they literally, after they killed him, they cut him up, and then they took those pieces and paraded them around like trophy. You know, again, who's the real savage in that? You know.
And didn't it take the tribe many years to rescue many of those body parts from places even like the Smithsonian?
Yes. With the advent of the NAGPRA, the Native American Graves Protection and Recreation Act, our people, the Cheyenne, Southern Cheyenne and Southern Arapaho tribes, the Cheyenne Arapaho tribes of Oklahoma, the Northern Arapaho tribe and Northern Cheyenne tribe in Montana, we were able to bring our people back, the bones, the heads, the skulls that were taken for analytical, to be analyzed, you know, because the U.S. military and everybody thought we were inferior, so they had to measure our skulls. But with that, it took a long time. But about 20 years ago, our grandparents, uncles, and different NAGPRA reps all went to D.C., and we prayed with those skulls and painted them and put them in boxes and brought them home and buried them on our tribal land at Conshohocken, Oklahoma, and Wyoming, and Montana. So those people are back home with their own people. They were lost for a long time.
Well, George, Levi, let's talk about your art, which is also okay. Incredibly powerful. And you use the ledger style.
Yes.
of traditional art mm-hmm. form that many of Cheyenne and Arapaho used. Can you tell us about that art form?
Yes. Ledger art is pictographic art. It's descended from the pictographic, like animal hide paintings, rock wall carvings, with the advent of the military and settlers coming across in the 1830s, 1840s. A Cheyenne man got a book, and it was first documented in 1840 at Bent's Fort in southeast Colorado, of a man drawing battle scenes. It started amongst the Cheyenne, and it spread to our traditional allies, the Arapaho and the Kiowa and the Western Lakota. Now, all those tribes did ledger art, but it started with our people. And I do the ledger art because, as a Cheyenne, that is a historical art form for us. It's not something we've seen, thought it was cool. Some of my ancestors that I can trace back were ledger artists back in the 1860s, 1870s. And you know, it's a way of, like Brent does, he said, it's a way of telling our story, because our men, it started out as men doing their battle scenes, but it also progressed into showing the daily life, the hunts, the raising of children. And I do the same thing. And I thought it would be good to use ledger art in my own way to portray, with mixed media ledger art, and just showing these scenes to convey my thoughts on this.
This is Lori Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am here with George Levi, Cheyenne artist, and Brent Learned, Arapaho artist, and Katie Anderson, director of the Clark County Historical Museum in Vancouver. And we're talking about the One November Morning Sand Creek Massacre exhibit, which is currently at the Clark County Historical Museum through May. And Brent and George, we wanted to talk a bit about what's been happening since the exhibition has appeared in both Colorado and at Northwestern University.
Okay.
And at Northwestern, because of the role of John Evans, who was governor of Colorado at the time, or the Colorado Territory at the mm-hmm. time of the massacre, Northwestern University, founded by him. So appropriate that this exhibit would travel to University of Denver and Northwestern University. Mm-hmm. And tell us about the student movements that have arisen as a result of students seeing these exhibits.
Well, at the University of Denver, you know, after displaying the pieces there and giving a talk, a lot of the students, asked, what could we do to change this way of thinking and everything? Because, let's face it, history has a way of repeating itself. And so some of the people that were part of the project, they were saying, hey, what we should do is institute that incoming freshmen to take a Native American studies class. So they're getting ready to try to implement that at the University of Denver. And at Northwestern University, there, after we did the project, a lot of the kids, for one, they didn't realize that their founder had a part in this, and two, they wanted to do something. And so the kids themselves said, hey, we want to change the name of the student union to Cheyenne Arapaho, because they felt that, hey, that would be their way of honoring our ancestors, which is nice, because you want to do something that will come full circle, because the irony of here's a man who basically committed genocide against our people, and 150 years later, he founded these two universities, and both these people are giving back to the community of trying to change their thing, trying to change their way of thinking, of going, hey, we feel bad about this. How can we make this right?
So this is a great example of how your art is beginning to change
yes.
minds and also mm-hmm. motivate people to bring about significant change in their
and those were changes that we didn't expect. That came from the students themselves.
Yeah. We also worked with faculty at Denver University, Anna Motti, Billy Stratton, Nancy Wadsworth, and they are pushing the university itself to create scholarships for Cheyenne and Arapaho students from Montana, Wyoming, and Oklahoma for free tuition. And they're also pushing for a memorial in the middle of the middle of the university itself. And they're asking our input, me and Brent as artists, to do that. And we have worked with the, they're working with the state of Colorado, and they're trying to their best they can, using any means possible, to inform the state of Colorado.
Great, great. Well, Katie, let's turn to you, Katie Anderson, director of the Clark County Historical Museum, about the impact of this exhibit, even though it just opened 2 days ago. Can you tell us about why it's significant to show this? And this is, I should add, the first showing on the West Coast, nearby in Vancouver. So we want to encourage everybody to get up to Vancouver to see this.
Absolutely.
What has been the reaction so far, just in the few days this has been opened?
People have been incredibly positive about this, and it was really gratifying at the opening during the program to see the kinds of questions and comments that people had, and that they were making the connection that we, that I saw immediately, the art is so powerful, to events that are happening today. And when you think about how this led the Cheyenne and Arapaho to be refugees for decades, pushed from fort to fort and then onto reservations and away from their homelands. And we see that happening in our world today. So it really is a wonderful opportunity for people to make that connection and have meaningful conversations. We had planned for the opening event to be from 4 to 6, and we ended up leaving about 8 o'clock. People wanted to keep talking, so it was really fantastic. And we have several events happening throughout the week. We're so honored that George and Brent took 9 days to come out and be with us. So they're going to be painting a mural, which we're really excited about, on Wednesday the 17th, and people can come out and watch them work their magic. So we encourage folks to do that. If they want to check out our website, cchmuseum.org, then all of the information will be there.
And there's a lot of programming, too. Brent and George will be speaking in a number of venues, including the Portland Art Museum, the Washington State University in Vancouver.
Yes, and Clark College as well.
So those times and places are listed on the website, Clark County Historical Museum.
The ones that are open to the public will be listed, yes. And they will be doing their program again at the museum on Friday from 6 to 8. And today we're going back to the museum, which is closed to the public, but we're going to have a private Native social day so that the local Native community can come in and experience the exhibition, see the artwork, and talk to George and Brent from noon to 8 today. So we encourage folks to come up and join us for that.
You know, this is such a sobering exhibit, but did want to mention a figure we were talking about earlier, Silas Sule, or Sewell, who's a figure in both of your works, George and Brent. Maybe you could talk about this figure and his significance to the Cheyenne Arapaho people.
Silas Sewell, he was a regular U.S. Army cavalry officer, and he was forced by Shivington from Fort Lyon to go to Sand Creek. And there was over 600 Colorado militia and cavalry people there, soldiers. And he and his command refused to fire upon the Cheyenne and the Arapaho because he saw that there was no need to, because they were protected under the United States flag and a white flag. And that is internationally recognized as being peaceful. And the old men were out there telling, we want peace, don't do this. So he ordered his men to stand down while all the other guys with their cannons and everything, they fired on to our people. Our people believe that as descendants, we wouldn't be here without this man ordering his command to stand down, because all of our folks that were there would have been killed.
Yeah, my piece it's called Portrait of Boral Courage. And it's like what George was saying, is that, you know, for this man to do defy orders and tell his men to stand down, that saved a generation. where the other one were generations lost, that, you know, those were our ancestors. And for this guy to do that, he's honored among the Cheyenne and Arapaho, and he's up there.
Well, thank you so much, George Levi, Brent Learned, and Katie Anderson, for joining us here today on KBOO in the Old Mole Variety Hour. And we want to remind listeners to try to see the amazing exhibit, One November Morning, The Sand Creek Massacre, which features the work of artist George Levi and Brent Learned. And there's a variety of programming around the exhibit. And really appreciate George and Brent joining us today and for sharing your time in this community for a full 9 days. And thank you, Katie Anderson, for organizing the exhibit, bringing it here for Portland and Vancouver.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, we sure appreciate you.
Thank you.
Yes, that was Lori Mercer and her guests, Brent Learned, George Levy, Katie Anderson. Check out their exhibit at the Clark County Historical Museum. Next on the Mole, more from Maria Swart, the National Director of the Democratic Socialists of America. Last week, we discussed the increasing willingness of U.S. North Americans to consider socialist ideas and candidates, and how her organization is working with the Bernie Sanders campaign. This is the first of many coming Old Mole interviews with U.S. socialist organizations on their ideas about Bernie. Maria and I both lamented that while Bernie was great on inequality and elite domination, he did less than he could be doing on building real authentic democracy. Goes way beyond just periodic managed elections. The last issue we discussed, that is Maria Swart and I, was climate change and its challenge to capitalism and strategy for the left. For reasons of time, this was cut from last week's show, and we decided to play it right today. You know, in your list of struggles that are now going on, and real challenges, in fact, to top-down rule, you didn't list the environmental movement, or I'm sort of active. It seems to me that as the impacts of global warming become more and more clear to more and more people, and the system does not respond, and the great threat to actually human life that global warming represents, there's going to be a lot of organizing and possibilities and thinking about what our new economy of real energy conservation, much less consumption, and a very different way of living, complete reconstruction of almost every big city in the world, because cities are really the source of greenhouse gas emissions. They drive the rape of the countryside, the demands of the cities, that there's going to be tremendous movements for change. I'll give you I'm sure you probably agree with that.
Yes,
you can have the last word on those possibilities and for radical change.
Well, I think that it's really important for socialists to remember that working class and poor people have to be the ones who build this movement. And they're the ones that are most affected by climate change. And you're already seeing that people fleeing Syria, it's connected to climate change. Here in New York City, our city was flooded a couple of years ago with Hurricane Sandy. Like people that are the most economically disenfranchised are the ones that are on the front lines. So we need to be really working together, organized people that think of themselves as middle class, but are actually working class, and working together with the ones that are most marginalized around this mutual self-interest. And climate change is a perfect example. And in one of the debates when Bernie said that climate change is the greatest national security threat, I was shocked, but so happy because it's so true. It's the greatest destabilizing force, and it's the one that we are feeling most directly. That's why it was 60 degrees a few days ago here in New York City. So I do think that it will cause a lot of people to realize something's wrong. The problem is we have to make sure that they don't have a reaction of looking for scapegoats. And that sort of brings me to what I think is the other key for socialists to think about, which is racial justice and building trust and connections between poor and white working class communities and poor and working class communities of color. And it's not because white poor people are more racist than wealthy white people. It's just that we need to work together more, right? So socialists have to constantly be thinking about the dynamics and building unity among working people. And climate change will bring conflict if we don't lay the groundwork for working together and working for a more democratic society that's in all of our best interests. So the planet doesn't simply cause us all to die off. So I totally agree with you. Climate change is a critical issue. Everybody can feel the effects, and we just need to spread the word about why that's happening. I also wanted to take a minute to let everybody know that there is a Portland DSA group, as I mentioned. They can find them on Facebook. Their page is PDX Democratic Socialists of America, and their email is dsa.portland@gmail.com. It's all volunteer run. We talk about these things, and then we engage in activism all the time, so I encourage folks to check it out.
Maria Swart, National Director of the Democratic Socialists of America, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Maria Swart, again, from the Democratic Socialists of America, coming up on the Old Mole. In the studio now, literary mole Larry Bolden reviews the novel The Other Typist by Suzanne Rendell.
They said the typewriter would unsex us. One look at the device itself and you might understand how they, the self-appointed keepers of female virtue and morality, that is, might have reached such a conclusion. Your average typewriter is a stern thing, full of gravity, its boxy angles coming straight to the point with no trace of curvaceous tomfoolery or feminine whimsy. So begins the humorous and entrancing debut novel of Suzanne Rendell, The Other Typist. Set in New York in the middle of the 1920s, the book has a nice mixture of mystery, feminism, and social commentary. Rose Baker is a typist for the New York City Police Department. Her job is to type up the confessions of those who have been arrested. Quite the proper, even prudish young woman outside of her job, her detective boss worries about the coarsening effect of listening to those confessions. But Rose says, "I'm largely indifferent to the content of the confessions I must take down and transcribe. Like the typewriter itself, I am simply there to report with accuracy. I am there to make the official and unbiased record that will eventually be used in court. I am there to transcribe what will eventually come to be known as the truth." Close quote. All goes well for the young Rose until another typist is hired, and the new typist, the other typist, is a young woman of a very different sort. She dresses in fine and provocative clothes, lives not in a modest boarding house like Rose, but in a rather fancy hotel. Rose wonders how Odalie, the other typist, can afford such a lush lifestyle on the meager income of a typist. At first she accepts Odalie's muttered explanation of a rich father, or some behind-the-scenes benefactor. But once she accepts Odalie's invitation to live with her, and is introduced by Odalie to the world of jazz and bootleg liquor in illegal speakeasies, she slowly comes to the realization that Odalie herself owns all or part of one of these clubs, and the source of her income is that underworld scene. She also comes to question more and more the whole notion of truth and truthfulness. Like so many mysteries these days, commentators suggest that if you liked Gone Girl and its complex intrigue, then you will probably like The Other Typist. In fact, this is a much better novel, and one that this reader at least thinks is far more subtle and psychologically interesting than Gone Girl. And I very much appreciated the feminist themes that crop up in the novel and provide much of both the humor and the intrigue. Although Rose soon comes to enjoy the jazz and bootleg liquor Odalie introduces her to, she does not so easily adopt Odalie's unconventional, even scandalous, sexual behavior. Quoting again from the book, "She, Odalie, acted as though it were the most natural thing for a woman to do whatever she wanted, with whomever she pleased. This confused me. You say, I didn't know then what I know now, which is this. Only the very rich and the very poor enjoy sex with a careless, indifferent abandon. Those of us who find ourselves in the middle, those of us in the middle class, are obliged to maintain an attitude of modesty and discretion when it comes to sex. This is especially true of middle-class young ladies. We are the ones obliged to lower our eyes and blush during educational lectures on human anatomy. We are the ones who must tisk and shout, fresh, with indignation whenever a young man tries to proposition us. We are given to believe that we are the keepers of sexual morality, and I, like any properly instructed schoolgirl of my day, earnestly felt that there was something sacred in the keeping. Some keep it as a matter of burden, but I kept it as a matter of privilege." Close quote. Slowly, Rose is sucked into Odalie's life, even to the point of risking her employment by lying for her on the job and falsifying some typed records that would implicate Odalie in illegal activities. Although Rindell manages to keep a light tone throughout this debut novel, the mystery that slowly unravels is an intriguing one, and the friendship, or is it more like a love affair, that she has with Odalie is psychologically intriguing. I think this is a first-rate little novel, sometimes dark, but always humorous and clever. It may seem lightweight in comparison with some of the excellent books I've reviewed lately, but I think it's well worth reading. If you start it, you'll have a difficult time putting it down. I've been talking about Suzanne Rindell's novel, The Other Typist. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, our host and our engineer and sometimes host. That was a wobbly singer-songwriter that I met back in Minnesota a few years ago. She posts her music under the title Beer and Roses on the website SoundClick. There are a lot of other classic kind of wobbly turnaround songs that play off popular melodies. And now here is Bill Resnick to finish out our show.
Okay, well, thanks, Joe, for twisting my arm to allow you to play one of your favorite songs and Promo, which was really a good singer. Thanks also to Larry Bolden for his review. Coming up on KBOO this morning at 10, Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we'll hear a report on the broad coalition campaigning to defeat the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. 10:15, Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein talks to environmental writer Jimmy Tobias about the senators, the oil lobbyists, the right-wing legislatures, who are the real threat to America's public lands. Clive and Bundy and the Bundy bandits are a minor threat in comparison to them. At 11 on the radio zine, Kristen Yant continues her coverage on the Portland Harbor Superfund site and the various remediation plans being considered by the EPA. At 11:30, we speak with reporter Daniel Forbes about his recent articles in the Portland Mercury on art glass factories in Portland and the high levels of toxic chemicals in nearby neighborhoods. And we'd like to thank KABU members for your generous support. If you're not a KABU member, you can become one by going to KABU FM and clicking on Donate Today. Next on The Old Mole, songstress, a songstress making her debut on the West Coast, Lena Brenner. She pre-recorded her version yesterday on KABU's recording stage at Southeast 8th and Burnside, her version of my favorite things.
Raindrops on roses and whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens. Brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things. Cream-colored ponies and crisp apple strudels. Doorbells and sleigh bells and schnitzel with noodles. Wild geese that fly with the moon on their wings. These are a few of my favorite things. Girls in white dresses with blue satin sashes. Snowflakes that stay on my nose and eyelashes. Silver white winters that melt into springs. These are a few of my favorite things. When the dog bites, when the bee stings, when I'm feeling sad, I simply remember my favorite things, and then I don't feel so bad.
That shows Julie Andrews, who can sing that song. That was Lena Brenner, 8 years old, one of my grandchildren. But I do insist, and it's an outrageous slander and categorically false to believe that our family connection had any influence, absolutely none, on my choice of music. Anyway, her sweet song did capture one of the themes of today's show, that it takes a while to transform young human beings into obsessive consumers of yachts, diamonds, and gaudy Trump Towers. I want to thank Lena for a lovely version of My Favorite Thing. Special thanks today also to Judy Sokol, our editor of the Rethinking Schools book, Rethinking Sexism, Gender, and Sexuality, to Laurie Mercier and her guests, Brent Learned and George Levy, to Cheyenne Arapaho artists who are spearheading with museum director Katie Anderson the one November morning exhibit that's opening at the Clark County Historical Museum in Vancouver. Also thanks to Maria Swart of the Democratic Socialists of America and to our engineer Joe Clement. This is KABU Radio in Portland, Oregon, live streamed to the universe, whoever you are out there. KABU is independent, supported by our listeners. No CEOs on our board of directors. Just us ordinary folks of an extraordinary species. All things considered, KABU is thoughtful and inspiring in our public affairs and our music and theater and our democratic governance as any radio on this planet. We deserve your support. We need it. We urge you to go to our website and become a member or make a contribution. Just go to the tip jar, upper right on our homepage. Well, that's all for the Old Mole today. We're ending a little bit early. Kathleen, you're about to put on our next show. Anyway, listeners, thanks. Yeah.
the 18th Annual Homelessness Marathon broadcast, a national town hall discussion on poverty and homelessness in America.
I think it would be pretty startling for the majority of the public to know that within about two blocks from the White House itself, there are homeless people sleeping in parks.
This year, we'll be live from the streets of Washington, D.C. That's the Homelessness Marathon broadcast, coming to you soon and heard right here on this radio station.
This station is KBOO Portland. Hear the Homelessness Marathon live beginning at 5 p.m. Wednesday, February 17th, and continuing until 6 a.m. Thursday morning.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, and as Bill mentioned, Air Cascadia is off today. Instead, we're going to hear an excerpt from the series Between the Lines on the broad coalition campaigning to defeat the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jessup Bonner of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who talks about the campaign to defeat the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement in the U.S. after the pact was signed in New Zealand on February 4th. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Fifteen years ago, the fertile fields near La Hormiga, Colombia, were filled with coca leaves growing everywhere and farmers flush with cash as a leftist insurgency prospered. This was ground zero for Plan Colombia, a massive multi-pronged effort funded by nearly $10 billion in U.S. aid that was launched in